broadcasting live from somewhere in the desert, posting up truth like a stamp in the corner of a letter. It's Leander Grace, that loud. Amid lies, we seek truth. Amid truth, we awaken. And once awakened, we speak truth everywhere. Now we're opening night and powering to reveal what's been hidden in plain sight. It's time for Leander Grace Out Loud, because your silence will not protect you. Oh, good Tuesday evening, everybody, and a hearty hello to all you folks out there. A great big shout out to all you MAGA folks, maybe those Anon or two. Welcome to Tuesday's Interlocution here on Holistic Truth, broadcasting live on Blog Talk Radio, part of a Natsarim network. It is Tuesday, March 26, 2024, and we are broadcasting once again on a Tuesday night live from the high mountain desert. Our goal today, as it is every day, is to help relieve suffering through empowerment by shining our light on and getting to the holistic truth. And speaking of, you know, it is still interlocutionarily speaking, but I think we're just going to call it Tuesday's Interlocution because it is much easier to say. I am your host, Leander Grace. It's good to be back with you here tonight. Last night we had our empathic channel. We talked about some things and some growth things and the way to look at things, had some callers come in. But tonight is an interlocution. It's just, it's intermediary program. Don't necessarily have a whole bunch to say, just taking up the headlines and talking about them, giving a progress report, as it were, to help us triage the different situations. In fact, we might even call this Triage Tuesday with interlocution, but then that's just real big and wordy and lots of verbiage and syllables, and it would cause us to digress. But we do continue to hold a space of peace, love, and grace as this great awakening continues to accelerate across our globe. And it is an exciting time to be alive. A lot of things are going on. A lot of people are becoming aware of things. And right now it seems as though, as we look out on the world stage, that there are some trying things, things that are trying to look at. Let me go ahead and I have a little cough drop there in my mouth that was interfering with my diction, and we don't want that to have happened. So remember, too, as you listen to the broadcast or the podcast, pod people, we love you to question everything. We are about the business of the one thing. We are not a part of the media, the mainstream media, the legacy media, or those who are put up to say things other than the truth. I do not expect you to take me at my word. It's not my place to convince you. I'm not trying to sell you an idea. We're here to spread the light, and the we is inclusive, of course. So research what you hear so you can own your own experience, and we are bringing into the experience this evening, folks. The topic is, let me scroll on down to that, it's a breaker, not a fixer, and then lawyers are us. And so we're going to be talking about that. We're going to be talking about some other things. Let me go ahead and get over here just to make sure that I'm reading it right off. That, yeah, it's Big Pharma and lawyers are us. It's a breaker, not a fixer. That's what we're going to be talking about and what that means as we go through the program. But before we do, before we get to our topics, I do want to talk a little bit, a lot, in fact, about our border. I just got an update. I was over on the news, different news stations, kind of getting last-minute updates to things that I'm not going to go into depth about, just to kind of give some headlines on it. And, of course, our prayers are out to the family members of the survivors of the bridge calamity on the Francis Scott Key Bridge. I about had my heart and my throat when I saw that. My whole gut just kind of dropped for a minute because, of course, we know that Francis Scott Key is the one who penned the Star Spangled Banner, if I'm not wrong. And so when I heard that, I was like, oh my goodness, let's not have it be a bad thing. You know, let's not do symbolism on it, and let's not read too much into it. Sometimes a bridge is just a bridge, but that bridge is more than that. It has a lot of significance to it. It adds to the commerce, the ability to commerce from one side of the inlet to the other. And it's a shipping lane, and all of those things now are there's no more commerce going on there. The shipping has to be held up, And all of the cargo has to be rerouted, and the cargo, I'm sure, on this particular ship is going to need to be inspected for damage and spoilage and things of that nature. So, and then of course the expense, and I'm not just going to say the inconvenience of having to drive around this once convenient bridge, but it is. It's going to add to traffic time. It's going to Mr. Buttigieg is going to have his secretary. Buttigieg has his work cut out for him managing this, but there is, I looked at the budget. I looked at that little minibus omnibus thing, and there's money in the budget to fix it. So, you know, we could, and this is what I wanted to ask a question about that, and I'm not trying to put a wrench in anybody's argument for anything, but this is a valid question, is that if the government, if the federal government pays for it, are they going to own it? And would it not be better to get a loan from the government to rebuild it? And of course, there's matching funds and stuff like that. But to get a low or a no interest loan from the government, that way, you know, get help paid back, pace that's affordable. And maybe not for the whole amount, of course, but, you know, we don't want to hamstring the state of Maryland either. I don't think. I wouldn't want to. And so, yeah, I would see helping them, but also as a matter of independence and them building it themselves and owning it and having autonomy for the bridge that's within their state rather than letting the federal nose, camel get its nose in the tent, you know, that might be something to consider. And I don't know just everything about everything, but it is something to consider on that. And I did get word that the Coast Guard has announced, you know, that they're ending the search and rescue effort, and it will be perhaps a recovery effort and all of that. That says there's six that are still missing and likely have not survived. So, you know, our hearts go out to those family, also to the family of royals as they're battling through the headline of news that's going on. And I don't say a whole lot about that, you know, the calamity that's going on, other than, you know, that their privacy needs are important. They are a family, after all, of real people with real needs for privacy. And I want to remind us that it was on August 31st, 1997, that, you know, that Diana died in the car crash at the Pointe d'Alma tunnel in Paris while her driver, and this is right out of Wikipedia here, her driver was fleeing the paparazzi. And it was at this point, people, I want to tell you, for those of you who didn't live through this time, and it was a time of insanity with the press. And the best photo got the best money. And so there were really unscrupulous shutterbugs, for lack of a better way to say it, that wanted to get the best picture for the high five. And so they were chasing Diana and Fayed, don't know how to say it, and their driver was Henry Paul, and the acting security, he was also the acting security manager of the Hotel Ritz in Paris. So all of these folks that were involved with it, when the paparazzi was chasing them as a matter of privacy, evidently they were speeding up, lost control of the vehicle, as the story goes, and they were all killed in the accident. None of them survived the accident. And it was at that point that everybody kind of stopped and said, whoa, because we had just come off of the OJ story where everybody was chasing down the highway and high-speed chase, and all of the world in America was transfixed on this blazer going down the highway like we didn't have anything else to do. I was just starting a new business at that point, and so I did have other stuff to do. But all my clients that I would visit, because I would do in-home visits, all of my clients, they were fixed to the screen on this OJ thing. And I was like, "Oy, I got enough to know what was going on." But anyway, this is my whole point, is that, you know, privacy for the families of those who are going through some troubling times. And like has been said by some of the other media personalities and some of the, you know, there's that they get to have their time too. You know, they get to do their mourning. They have children, they have needs, they have conversations that need to have, and it's their life and it's their privacy. And for us to be guessing and interjecting those things that we think before we know, it can be harmful. It's harmful. It's hard to take it back. And it's not fair. It's not right. So we might want to check ourselves on that as we go forward for those who are in the limelight or celebrity status, that, you know, we're not getting our attention needs met by pretending that, you know, we can get, you know how that goes. So there you have that. So something else I want to say about getting your attention needs met is no sooner now, guys, this is really quite sad to me, actually, is Ronna McDaniel. Now, I haven't held anything back about the way I thought that things were going, and I'm not going to take anything back, but I'm going to say this about that. Fair is fair, right is right. And Ronna McDaniel was evidently hired at NBC News because the people who do the hiring and the firing, the bosses, the ones who own the place, they have a right to hire and fire and do that. And so they hired Miss Ronna McDaniel, and they all whined and cried like whiny titty babies as if they're the ones that are running it. And they hired the bosses. That's kind of the way it was on the Plymouth Oak. I heard some of the things that they said, and I'm thinking to myself, I said, self, that would be me, Leander Gray, self. I said, self, what would I do if people that work for me were belly aching to the very public that I'm paying them to report to? Because that's what they were doing. They were drawing their audience into the conversation to put pressure on their bosses. They were using their audience. They were emotionally using and manipulating their audience, getting them on their side of the desk and putting pressure on their bosses. If I was their bosses, I'd fire every damn one of them and put the juniors up on the desk because they're clearly more hungry to be successful than the whiny babies that are trying to run the boss's job. That's just me. Because whether I do agree or do not agree with Ronna McDaniel on Daniel, pardon me for missaying her name. Let me get a drink. Got to clear my throat. Got to get a drink. It's that stuff here. Let me get that. Whether I or you do or do not agree with Ronna McDaniel, the ones who make the decisions at the studio, the ones who do the hiring and the firing, the ones who had this contract with her and need to make it good or they're opening themselves up for a big old lawsuit, every one of those loudmouth, weeny whiny, we're running it and you're not women that were out there telling everybody how it was going to be because they said so, that's grounds to me for dismissal. And I'd pay their contract to get them off the air because they're making you look bad. They are. They're making you look bad. And so, you know, if I, as an employer, if I had a bunch of employees bad-mouthing and otherwise bally squawking about a decision that I made to the very people that I'm paying them to speak to and to report to and to represent me by face, demeanor, and content, out the door. Let's bring in more, and that would be my decision. Bring those in who might have a penchant for journalism rather than a bunch of mean girls and boys getting together to tell everyone how the cow ate the cabbage, understanding that they don't own the cow and they don't own the cabbage, and they're just there to do a job. But that's just me. So the executives caved to the weeny whinies, and they look very foolish doing so. They have a choice in who they hire, and they acted as if they don't. Now, the next time that they want to make an executive decision and they decide to weeny whiny and belly ache to the very listeners that you were, or the very viewers, rather, that you were paying them to deliver the news to, or at least read a script to, then I would have, you know, I'd think about stuff. You gave up your leverage. So I don't know. It's up to you all, but that's what I saw. And if I was the boss, that's what I would do. But I'm not their boss. I am the boss of me. Well, no, actually, I have a boss too, but I do digress. So let's take a look at Michigan real quick. Michigan launched a program offering up to $500 a month in rental assistance for illegal immigrants. They call them newcomers. We know that they are illegal entrants. Now, let me tell you a story here. It was back in about 2011-ish, somewhere around there. And I was staying with some folks, and they were renting out some rooms. And they had rented out three more rooms than they had in their house, I believe is what they had said. And they were and they had rented out their address. They rented out their address to illegal aliens that had come across and needed an address and a sponsor. And so although those people had never stepped foot on the property, they were receiving a rent amount for the rooms on their property, and nobody was actually living there. So this is a racket. It can become a racket very easily. And my question to the governor of Michigan is, why are you incentivizing the housing of criminals? They're going to, she's evidently given offering a $500 rental assistance incentive to those who are willing to house those who are here criminally. Now, it may sound like a great big heart and go and beat, beat, beat for our brothers and sisters that are less fortunate, but it's not. These are criminals come across the border looking for safe haven until, we don't know what that until is, but we do know that there are a lot of them. And I'm wondering why there are those governors that still have sanctuary states, sanctuary cities, and are further paying people to help folks break the law. So this is not a, it's not a fixer, it's a breaker, right? This isn't going to fix anything, it's going to break it. It is. This whole thing of incentivizing rental system, it's a breaker. It's not a fixer. And you can't say it any other way. Something else that seems to be a breaker and not a fixer is the Biden regime now is considering, at least the Brandon of the Biden regime, is considering granting amnesty and handing out green cards to illegal immigrants. And now I told you guys this some time ago, don't know what episode it is, but we're seeing it, is that everything that seems to be normal for Americans, citizens to have, those who are coming across illegally and criminally and entering into our borders, into our nation, are being handed everything as if they went through everything to earn it, as if they have any allegiance, as if they're supposed to be here and they've made it normal. They've already been giving them driver's license out and some form of ID out, and they're already trying to make it legal for the locals, illegal immigrants, to vote, which is an illegal count. They can't do that. And once they're in there, it's body count, not vote count on some of those issues. And so, yeah, they're tipping. They're tipping the population to those who have no idea what it is to be American, but they know what it is to crash a party and insist that the host give them everything that they want. And speaking of given everything they want, the Mexico president has warned that the crisis will worsen if U.S. doesn't cave to his demands. That was the verbiage that was given out on Fox News. Now, who is he? Right, and we said on the other program, we think it was last night, I brought up, I said, let the cartels pay for that, put the pressure on that. You know, and he says that the migration is going to continue, this illegal immigration is going to continue unless we start forking out money to other nations. And it's like, that doesn't do any good, because the people that are in the other nations are the ones that are staying. The patriots to the other nations are staying. It's the criminals that are migrating. Do we see this? The patriots stay behind and rebuild. There may or may not be very many of them, but it's the criminals that are migrating here, those that want to get something for nothing, those that have no problem breaking our very first do not come in here without permission law. And then we have all kinds of corruption, and they, under the color of law, they have all of these little statutes that go against the actual laws to pave the way around the law to let these people who don't belong here to come in here and do those things that we don't want done. They're bringing fentanyl. They're bringing children for sale, and they're hurting the children on the way as well as the women. They're bringing slave labor. Don't think for a minute that this doesn't have a corporate tang to it, where they want this lower slave labor housed somewhere so that they can pull it out at some time to work for them. Not to mention the terrorists in the 120 countries, I think, what we're up to now. And then, of course, there's other slave types as well. So I still think that they're bringing up their, they're buying up the land, and then they're shipping in to the southern border all of the help that they want. And if they're all speaking the same language and they're all invading us with their different languages, then we become confused, do we not? Because we're told not to be racist. Well, we don't. We're not racist just because we want to protect our home. Let me get a drink. So that's what's going on the southern border. Biden say, yeah, come on in. And not only that, we'll give you a green card. Yeah. And I know a lot of people that lost their green card status and that were valid green card holders, and they weren't Hispanic. They were from up north or from somewhere else. They wanted to come here, and they had green cards to work. And it's the same scam that they played before during the Obama regime, when the same people who are trying to run it now without any major puppets, they don't know which direction to go. But this is what they had planned, to open the borders. We've talked about it before on the broadcast. So we're going to talk a little bit more about Lawyers Are Us, but before we get to the Lawyers Are Us, I want to talk about some of the cases that the lawyers need to revisit and talk about, because they're about to hang everybody in the FDA out to dry because the lawyers don't take blame for much. Let me give you a case in point. You know, before the Supreme Court today is an argument, and I don't know that they're going to make a decision on it either, but there's an argument about, they're hearing a case about the drug mifepristone, which is Mifeprex, and what it's called, the morning after pill or early chemical, it's a late chemical in abortion-induced chemical, or chemical-induced abortion. And I want to talk a little bit about this, not a lot about it, but I want to talk a little bit about this. Justice Brown got it right when she asked the question, you know, do the people really want justices or expect the justices on the bench to have an in-depth medical knowledge to be able to decide this? This is a good question. Now, the validity of her question is right, you know, whether she is up to everybody else, but it is a good question. Do we expect that level of medical knowledge to exist on the bench? And do the justices on the bench have at their fingertips, with all due respect to the justices on the bench, tutors in every area of specialty that are not otherwise politically or financially obliged to lean one way or the other? That might be something. And I do not mean any disrespect to the bench whatsoever. In fact, Justice Brown got this right when she asked this question, because when it comes to this abortion pill for lactate, that's exactly what it is, a pill to induce abortion. The safety feature comes to mind. Whether somebody is for abortion or against abortion, we're radical left, radical right, no, not never, you know, there's all kinds of percentages of viewpoints on this, all kinds of degrees on the scale. But the FDA has failed us, we the people. Now, remember, the FDA is a private corporation, but its mandate is to review and approve or deny approval of foods, drugs and other substances that are going to be sold at a retail level to we the public. And they're supposed to be smart enough and obligated to our welfare enough to make good decisions. And in this case, the FDA has gotten it wrong in approving the Mefaprex for over-the-counter use. And now we have this time taken before the Supreme Court of the United States because doctors who are very concerned about this, and you don't have to be a doctor withstanding with conscientious objection to be a doctor withstanding, because hopefully the doctors would be standing for us. Now, I don't want to stretch the lengths and the intention of the law and what the word standing means, but it can be resubmitted to the court, I would imagine. But the ones who do have standing in this is we the people overall, every one of us, because this is a drug that can cause a lot of harm without medical supervision. It can cause a lot of harm with medical supervision. This particular medication can cause a lot of harm. There's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts about it. And once it's offered over the counter, all those ifs, ands, and buts go out the window because people are not going to self-educate. Not all people are capable of self-educating. Not everybody is going to understand the level of danger that comes with over-the-counter use of this medicine, of this pharmaceutical product. Now, whether you're anti or pro or in the middle abortion doesn't matter. It's not an abortion argument at this point. If it's an abortion argument and the doctors want to claim to have standing for that, then that's fine. But I would like to submit that we the people have standing, but not necessarily with the Supreme Court to bring it to here, but definitely to have Congress investigate why it is, investigate the FDA. Because there's space for conversation here also. I have a note here on my copy. It says we have space here. There's space for conversation here, and we'll get to that either before the break or after. We just have a few minutes before we get to break. But the physicians who are adamantly opposed for one reason or another, usually religious reasons, And they have standing because what happens with these women that are desperate to end the pregnancy, that do not have the education necessary and poo-poo the instructions away, and the doctor has no baseline from which to work, they take this pill and there are so many things that can go wrong with it. So many things. Does that mean that this is not a safe medication? Under the care of a physician, it's between the patient and the physician. But if you are a God-fearing doctor in the ER and a woman comes in to the ER, and I'm going to end this in a way that most people are not going to expect it, and they have taken this medication, and now you are forced to assist. You're no longer forced to assist in an abortion. You're being forced to assist in saving a life that would not otherwise have been put in danger had this not been put out on the market willy-nilly with no education and no forethought for the well-being of the women that would be taking it. This is not an aspirin. This is not, what did someone say? This is not an Advil. This is not safe outside of a physician's care. If I was to give a protocol for this, it would be in the hospital just like anything else would be that has this much force on a woman's body. This is treacherous to a woman's body. And if her and her physician decide to go through this much treachery on the woman's body to effectively end the pregnancy, that it remains to be between the physician and the doctor in this case. And the reason I'm making this exception in this case is simply because there is biblical standing for this. There is biblical standing, there is scriptural standing, or there's scriptural reference, there's scriptural history for ending a pregnancy by chemical inducement. And I believe it's in Leviticus when the priests are instructed how to induce the expulsion of a pregnancy through means of a chemical concoction, through a solution that the priest knew how to make for the case of these judgments. So it is not out of you know, the limits of being able to apply this particular medication in instances that are necessary. But there should be guardrails with it as well, because if this medication, the way it works, its mechanism of operation, it should be taken before, not after, not at, but before the 10th week. And the reason is because it has a progesterone that's involved, and the way it is shifted around. But there are so many things to look out for during pregnancy, especially today, because our bodies have gone through some changes, and the women's bodies are sometimes hostile to pregnancy. There are some women who are prone to ectopic pregnancies, and if you try to use this for an ectopic pregnancy, it will not work, and the woman could die of a bursted fallopian tube. I mean, it's that serious. We need doctors involved. And so what I would say to the physicians, and this is just me, you know, the way I see it having to do with the scriptures, is that there is precedent, scriptural precedent set for ending a pregnancy, and it would be for the very three exceptions that we have talked about before, for rape, incest, and in scriptural case, it's for adultery. The husband asks for the expulsion of the fetus that's not his, or the pregnancy that's not his. So there is scriptural precedent for it, but it's very narrow, and it's up to the priests and the judges and how that would translate into our law. I would leave out to our legislators if they even felt the need to touch this at all. We don't need to protect women with law. We need to protect women with education. And guidance and care under a physician. I cannot imagine the angst that the women are going through, that they want to end their pregnancy. I cannot imagine the pain that they would be going through once there's a complication. And I cannot imagine the horror that the attending physician in the ER is going to be going through when he understands the whole predicament that just walked in his room. So all of this together makes a great big scary story. It's a breaker, this medication. It's not a fixer, this medication. It's neither of those. But in the right hands, in the right circumstances, with the right physician for the right reasons, then yes, this can help out. But we also have to understand that it wasn't the first use of this medication. So there's a great big medical picture that we have to keep into focus when we're bringing in things of this nature. So do we need the judges making medical decisions like this? I don't know. If they're going to be asked to, should we not take it through the Congress first and put pressure on the FDA and perhaps fire all of the idiots that put this over the counter and put so many of our young women in danger by giving them something poisonous and telling them that it was safe, and not giving them any instructions or hand-holding and real education on how to use this. And if we are going to allow this before the 9th week, we should also make sure that those parts that are going to be expelled aren't going to be ending up on the market. Because that's the whole reason for Planned Parenthood, is they're planning their own things. And their own things require dead baby body parts. And sometimes it requires baby body parts that are alive. It's not always going to be comfortable what I bring to you, but I am going to bring you the truth. I am your host, Leanna Grace. This is Tuesday. It is collusion, interlocution. We're going to keep saying that word over and over until it just becomes something normal. But it's big and challenging. It sounds really fancy, and I like the way it I like what it means. So this is Tuesday's interlocution. I am your host, Leanna Grace. We're going to take a little bit of a break here and just remind folks that we got to be who we are and be part of the plan. This is Dan Fogelberg. We'll be back on the other side. Just about three? Yeah, yeah. We'll be back. Lies, we seek truth. Amid truth, we awaken. It's Leanna Grace Out Loud, because your silence will not protect you. Oh no, the silence will not protect us, so we're going to talk about stuff, we're going to talk about it loud, and we're going to share those things with you. So tonight's topic is, it's a breaker, not a fixer, and we talked about that with all of the things going on. Biden's not a fixer, it's a breaker, not a fixer. You know, he's handing out amnesty cards is what he's thinking about doing. He's handing out a roadway and a legal roadmap, his whole regime is, around our constitutional laws, putting us in danger, bringing crime to every street. Every state is a border state now, and there isn't any place in the United States that's not being affected by the crime that Biden regime has led in through the border, and they had to have been done on purpose, because it was, for the most part, for all intents and purposes, it was secure under the prior president, under Donald J. Trump. And then when he sat down in the office, all of his little dream regime gathered around and said, sign this, and signed away everything that made our border secure. And started signing away a whole lot of other things, a lot of our money, a lot of our gear, a lot of our safety went right out the door. So he's a breaker and not a fixer. And I want to talk about another breaker and not a fixer, and that is the guy, this dude, Michael Cohen dude, right? This Michael Cohen dude, you know, I didn't follow it a whole lot at first, who this guy was and where he was going, what he was doing, because I was focused on other things. And so he's come back into the headlines and back into the sites, and it's like, this dude's a real piece of work. Right, I mean, he's like a real piece of work. And when I'm doing this reading through the magazines, AP and through all these other places, it's like way back in 2016 and 2017, they started calling him, they were saying that he was President Trump's fixer. You know, and I'm like, well, I need one of those. I need someone who comes up behind me and make sure that I don't doo-doo on my own rug or make myself look, you know, like a number one, basically, first officer. That's not what he was, though. He was a lawyer, did lawyer things, and evidently he was supposed to look out. And, you know, he has this whole oath of protecting his client's information and, you know, client lawyer privilege, stuff like that. Well, it seems that went out the window with this dude. Let me go ahead and get a drink. Nice. We'll rewarm, nice hot cup of coffee here. Let me slurp it. Can you hear how good that is? That's a good cup of coffee right there. I just want to tell you. But, and it is a fixer. Hey. But this guy, Michael Cohen, he's already been convicted of here. Let me pull this up because I've got the headlines in front of me here. I pulled them up so I could share them with you. There's a couple of things that come into my view. I'm like, what? So the Southern District of New York, now this was back in 2018, in August 21st, 2018. You know, Cohen pled guilty in Manhattan federal court to 8 counts, including criminal tax evasion and campaign finance violations. And some of that's going to be bleeding over, I guess, into some of these trials of what he did with some. This guy is a piece of work. Now, I don't know. We don't have checks anymore, but there's this whole thing that used to happen when young people would first get their bank account. They learned how to do what's called flying checks or kiting checks. You know, you fly one from one account to the other. And it seems like that's what this guy was doing, was flying money from one to the other and not telling one banker his, you know. Anyway, he was playing it fast and loose. He was doing that. He was breaking laws and doing things he ought not to do. And the court found out about it, and he pled to some of it and pled out of some of it. You know how that goes. But basically, he lied all over the place. And so when he got caught lying all over the place, it seems that he brought somebody else into it. And a fixer wouldn't do that. A breaker would. Someone who's going to break something would do that, lie in wait and have a stumbling block set up down the road, or maybe set it up where somebody else can take the fall. You know, we're looking in the headlines where Otani is being looked at really closely when it's his bookie is the one that's doing all the things that are wrong. And I'm wondering if we're not seeing a parallel or a mirror of that, right? Where we've got a real estate broker, businessman who's very wealthy, right? Donald J. Trump, very wealthy, and becomes the target of accusations of one or another. And that, But here's the thing. What I remember him saying is he wouldn't settle. He's not going to pay out for something that he didn't do. So if that is true, then something else in all of this has to be false. That's my thinking. I don't know. I haven't delved into it. I'm just looking on the surface. I have no inside information other than what is available open source. But what I see in front of me is someone that's a breaker. and that there is part of the story has got to be missing, because I remember distinctly President Trump saying several times, you know, you never settle. You don't pay up when you don't owe it. You don't settle and admit part of guilt. And so I'm weighing these words out back and forth, and I'm wondering how this is all going to turn out. But I do want to folks to remind that Mr. Whack-A-Mole, well, he's not actually the Whack-A-Mole, but he does seem to have his finger in a lot of different pies. And even though he is guilty of all these things, it doesn't necessarily, just like the bookie, you know, not his bookie, but his translator has all this relationship with the bookies, you know, Otani didn't do it. It wasn't Otani, it was his translator. And I'm wondering if there's a lot of things that went on that we'll be finding out, that it was the breaker and not the fixer, because, you know, he may have helped to a point, but he ends up being a liar and a crook overall. That's just the way that is. You can't say that any other way. And yet, this being the case way back in 2018, he still decided that the one of the judges, I guess it was, what, Ergodon, that guy, he still decided that he was a credible witness, although he had absolutely nothing to gain, to lose in lying, and everything to gain in satisfaction of bringing somebody down who would no longer be there to grease wheels. That's my words, not anybody else's words, but this looks very suspicious. This guy looks rotten. And I think he's just, I don't know. We'll have to see how this goes down. Let me get a drink. But if somebody, in my view, if somebody had been convicted of all of this and lying before Congress and all of those charges compile and keep going on, we can just add to it. And then he comes back and say, well, I didn't really commit that, but I copped to it, because, okay, so you lied again. And so his word, his integrity comes into question. Why would anybody consider him a credible witness? Why would anybody consider his word credible over someone who has not been convicted of lying, has not been convicted of a felony, has several accusations on the table? Because if they can keep the pressure on, it seems as though they want to interfere with the election, hope something sticks. That's my guess. Don't know, but that's my guess. We've got the law, and then we have all these guys that have the title of lawyer that do they practice everything but law. Not all of them. Let me clear my throat. Some of them have got to be good, otherwise we'd all be in a lot of trouble, because we do have good lawyers standing up. We do have good legislatures standing up. We do have good folks. But just to draw your attention to one of the obvious failures of, in my opinion, of the Ergodon Court, is a failure to look up and research and be aware of what is going on with the properties. Now, did the DA, not the DA, but the AG, did Letitia James, the AG, did she know the value of the properties? Did she do research of the properties, or is she going by a buy and sell thing? Because I want to share this with you guys. This is straight from the Smithsonian Magazine, the ironic and iconic, the ironic history of Mar-a-Lago. And this was written in November of 2017. I had downloaded it and saved it, but I couldn't find it. So I'm glad it's still posted online and nobody's taken out. This was written by Michael Luongo. And back in the day, at the first advent of that property, which in Palm Beach property, which is called Mar-a-Lago, it was back in the day in the 1920s, it was owned by none other than Marjorie Merriweather Post, Miss Post. Now, for those of you who are older than a minute, her last husband, or her second to the last husband, her third of fourth of four husbands, don't judge, was none other than E.F. Hutton. And we all know that when E.F. Hutton talked, everybody listened, if we'll remember that. So this particular property has a history of prestige. It's not just a golf club. It's a little bit more than that. It's not just a Palm Beach resort. It's a little bit more than that. The history is rich. for this particular property. And it goes back for a very long time. In fact, when she bought it, she wanted it to become the official wintertime presidential retreat. That's what she wanted. She wanted to make this and have it become that. Now, that was back then. Now, in about 1950, 1960s, all of these great big ostentatious properties were considered white elephants. And the reason is because they were not just great, big, and beautiful and ostentatious, but they required a lot of capital to keep up. All of those, the large properties that have these high decorative addendums, as it were, all of these highly decorated properties in the 20s, they had history with them and ingrained into them, but they were definitely a lot to maintain. And so when she died, she wanted to make sure they had a large history. So I'll go ahead and put this on this, but she wanted to leave these properties to the states, some to Florida and some to New York and all of that, but none of those places that she was going to give them to wanted to take them because of the costs of maintenance on these. And it says, as the social seasons, this is in the same article from the Smithsonian Magazine, as the social seasons came and went, however, Palm Beach tastemakers' tastes changed. The grand houses they built in the 1920s were seen as white elephants, Murray says, and were raised in the 50s and the 60s. That means they were lowered. They just took them and put them on the ground. They didn't want them anymore because of, again, the cost to maintain and upkeep. And so Miss Post had arranged for all of the properties to be distributed. And so the one that was out Mar-a-Lago, it was supposed to be donated to Florida, but the state officials didn't want the maintenance cost. So in 1968, there was transferring of things going on. And when she died, there was a push to have it be made part of the federal government, but, you know, of the whole idea that she had as a White House property. But again, the federal government declined for the same reasons, and the article says, for the Floridians and that the Smithsonian did. So nobody wanted this property. Three potential sales collapsed before Donald Trump bought it in 1985, paying a reported $8 million for the estate and its furnishings, a small fraction of the original cost. Now understand, what she had put into this property when all was said and done was about $7 million. Was it $7 million? What does it say here in the article? Because it tells us, you know, what the property was valued at and what the value of then and now is. And this is saying, let me go ahead and get through to it. Let me get the dollar maps. Yeah, it's got 42-foot ceilings, 110,000 square feet, glinted with gold leaf, Spanish tiles, Italian marble, and Venetian silks. All told, Post spent $7 million, somewhere north of $90 million today. So that's just the adjusted investment amount. That has nothing to do with what's been added to it and some of the other improvements and addendums and otherwise add-ons and stuff that it's gone through since President Trump has had it. So this property is rich in history and rich in meaning, even to our American culture. It's one of the very few remaining large, ostentatious white elephant buildings from the 1920s. Most of the buildings from that time, if they're not in the middle of the city, have been, as this article says, razed to the ground as if they never existed. And within those buildings themselves is a rich history of how things evolved on this land. So I just wanted to put a bid in, for yay, yay, rah, rah, go Mar-a-Lago and go Donald J. Trump for keeping it and holding it and keeping that part of history breathing for us and that. So that's what I wanted to say. And not, you know, not just that. Okay. So I wanted to give a little bit of a praise and glorification to Mar-a-Lago so that my listeners understand that it's some Spanish colonial villa turned golf club. There's a whole lot more to it than that, if those walls could talk. So the other thing, you know, with Michael Cohen committing perjury, something else I wanted to bring up interlocutionarily here on tonight's broadcast, because I really don't know that I want to spend any time on that. I want to talk about something else tomorrow night on holistic truth. But the Manhattan DA, and now that's the district attorney, that's Alan Bragg. And so Letitia James is the attorney general. And then, of course, under her is the district attorney, Alvin Bragg. And he's in charge of his district area. And he actually hired a former DOJ official who previously investigated the Trump Foundation. Now, I want you to understand, this guy, now his name is Matthew Colangelo, and he was in the DOJ and worked under Biden and I believe even Clinton. I'm looking up here at an ABC News article as they're putting out quite a bit of information on that too. But anyway, his first claim to defame, his first infamous act, was leading the New York Attorney General's opposition to the Trump administration's effort to add a citizenship question to the U.S. Census. So remember back then, back in the 20, you know, when we had the, when it turned in, we needed the census taken. It happens every 20 years, every 10 years, every 20, and as often as it happens, President Trump questioned on there, are you a citizen? And the reason to ask that is because if you're not a citizen, then you don't belong in the census to add for votes. And see, that's the thing. The Constitution doesn't ask about citizenship. The assumption is that the people that are here are the ones that belong. And so they're supposed to count the people, the citizens. And so we need to make sure that we count the right ones and don't count those who aren't supposed to be here and those who are criminals and are otherwise obstructing our own laws, whether by accident or design. Let me get a drink. So this Colangelo dude, he got promoted all the way up to DOJ, and then he's just been bouncing around to different places. It's like anywhere that Trump is being prosecuted, he wants to be there. So personal vendetta, hello. I think he wants to, you know, it's like, I want to bring him down. Not that he said that. I don't know that he said that, but it seems as if through his actions that he's pretty scope-locked on President Trump. And I don't think that obsession's healthy either for him or for our justice system or for the case and those involved, because when you get that much of a personal investment, so much so that he's going to go from the Department of Justice and work beneath himself just so that he can put the screws to somebody regardless of justice. If he was interested in justice, then he would want to take what he learned and go to a higher court so he could be like supervisory and over that, would he not? But no, he seems like he's got himself scope locked on an individual rather than scope locked on the law. And that seems to me to be the beginning of the perversion of justice. And I, again, focus our attention to Attorney General Letitia James. So some of the things that are going on in this are a little bit hard to track, you know, for most of us. But we're tracking as best we can. And we're going to start bringing these challenges. And hopefully I can put out briefly what it is that Miss Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York, might want to take a look at, because she's stepping in a way that she might end up stepping in it if she keeps going. And, you know, I'm trying to defend the law, looking out for her too, sort of, kind of, because she said she likes the law. I am your host, Leanna Grace. I hope you found value in tonight's broadcast or podcast. Pod people, we love you too. We'll be back tomorrow night. Next week, again, I think we'll have this interlocutionary thingy bopper and continue with it. I kind of like the way it's flowing and going. We'll see how we're led to go forward with that. I am your host, Leanna Grace, and I'm reminding you too, as always, to watch for the signposts, connect the dots, find your path, live in love, and do something good as we learn to forgive. And we will awaken that is off to a good night.